determined to kill as many of us as he could, Cherry wrote. Several minutes passed, however, and the men heard nothing more. The forest's heavy silence in the wake of the single shot was more sinister than a fusillade, threatening to break at any moment and from any direction. At the intermediate station, the Americans realized that the silence might mean that Giulio was making his way back to the last camp, and his next victim, Pedrinho. The guard who had caught Giulio stealing food earlier in the day was not only unaware of the murder, but also alone and unarmed. Roosevelt's health had continued to deteriorate since his accident a week earlier, but despite his physical frailty, the murder of one innocent man and the imminent threat to another triggered in him a lifelong instinct for action. To Kermit and Cherry's dismay, Roosevelt suddenly pulled himself to his feet and lunged for the same group of rifles from which Giulio had taken his murder weapon just minutes earlier. Ordering his son and the naturalist to guard the canoes and supplies, he set off to warn Pedrinho, a rifle clenched in his hand. Before we could stop him, he had started down the path where Giulio had disappeared, Cherry wrote. Without hesitation, he himself chose to go back over a trail on which the murderer might be concealed. Roosevelt, followed closely by Dr. Cajazeira, who had raced after him with a revolver at his side, did not get very far before he found Paixón. The young man lay face down near an abandoned pile of baggage, his lifeless body crumpled and still, a pool of blood slowly spreading beneath him. Giulio had shot Paixón straight through the heart, and he had dropped dead on the spot, pitching forward until he slammed into the soft forest floor like a felled tree. The murderer, Roosevelt determined, had stood to one side of the path and killed his victim when a dozen paces off, with deliberate and malignant purpose. Now that he had seen with his own eyes what Giulio was capable of, Roosevelt's concern for Pedrinho and sense of urgency redoubled. Struggling on with his infected leg, he pushed past Paixón's body and continued to make his way to the last camp, searching for any signs of Giulio. When they finally reached the camp, Cajazeira swiftly and silently stepped in front of Roosevelt. "My eyes are better than yours, Colonel," he said. "If he is in sight, I'll point him out to you, as you have the rifle." Giulio, however, was nowhere to be seen. Pedrinho was unharmed, but the murderer had disappeared. They realized that he must be hiding somewhere in the forest, probably not far from where he had shot Paixón. By that time, the other officers had reached the scene of the murder. After Roosevelt left, Kermit and Cherry had waited at the intermediate station until they found two camaradas who could be trusted to guard the canoes and supplies. It had taken Lira and Rondon nearly half an hour just to get word of Paixón's death and to make their way back to the muddy stretch of trail between the station and the last camp. Lira, who was still struggling to lower the canoes over the falls, had heard about the tragedy first and had sent a camarada to tell Rondon. After instructing his men to continue their work, cutting a path along the cliff face, the Brazilian commander had left immediately. The four men finally met on the forest trail, gathering around Paixón's body. Rondon had seen many dead men during the quarter century that he had spent in the Amazon. He had watched them in their death throes, unable to help as they writhed in agony with a poisoned arrow in their chest, burned with fever until they fell into a disease-induced coma, or withered away from starvation. But he had never before seen one of his own men kill another out of pure hatred. When he looked down at Paixón, he saw senseless death, a wasted life, a sacrifice that had gained nothing for the Telegraph Commission's greater mission, or even for this single expedition. The murder sparked a deep-seated outrage in Rondon. Despite his great discipline, the Brazilian colonel was, Kermit would later write in his diary, in a blind rage to kill Giulio. As Rondon would later describe the strange events of that day, however, it was his hot-blooded American co-commander, not he, who demanded an eye for an eye. After finding Paixón, the four officers walked back to camp looking for Roosevelt. "When I met him," Rondon later recalled. He was very pent up. Julio has to be tracked, arrested, and killed, Roosevelt barked when he saw Rondon. In Brazil, that is impossible, Rondon answered. When someone commits a crime, he is tried, not murdered. Roosevelt was not convinced. He who kills must die, he said. That's the way it is in my country. If they found Julio, Rondon argued, they should apply the laws of the Brazilian government, not wilderness justice. Rondon believed, his faithful friend and soldier Amilcar would later explain, that the evildoer should be taken in and fed, demanding that he would work in return for the food he was entitled to, although he would still be a prisoner awaiting contact with the civilized world in order to eventually be duly tried. Ever the pragmatist, however, Roosevelt thought that it would be folly to subject themselves to a dangerous man and to ask their camaradas to share their scarce rations with a thief and murderer. As they argued, Roosevelt and Rondon were literally handed a quick, if temporary, resolution to their situation, in the form of the .44-caliber Winchester rifle that Julio had used to kill Paixón. Although Rondon had doubted that Julio could be found in the tangle of trees and vines that flanked the trail, he had sent two men, Antonio Correa and Antonio Paresi, to search for him. The two camaradas found the spot at which Julio had fled into the jungle and quickly disappeared from sight. Moments later, the officers heard a cry of surprise, and Antonio Correa stepped back onto the trail, holding the murder weapon in his dirt-streaked hands. Julio, they realized with great relief, had lost his rifle as he fought his way through the thick vegetation. Perhaps hearing someone coming along the path, he fled in panicked terror into the wilderness, Roosevelt speculated. A tree had knocked the carbine from his hand. Broken branches and matted leaves told them that Julio had doubled back to retrieve the rifle, but then must have been frightened away by the voices of the other men as they discovered Paixón's body. His murderous hatred had once again given way to his innate cowardice, Roosevelt wrote with contempt. Now that they knew Julio was unarmed, Roosevelt and Rondon's desperation to find him, whether to kill him or to imprison him, was diffused, at least for the moment, and they could finally turn their thoughts to Paixón. Someone had laid a handkerchief over the dead camarada's face, but it was still hard for them to believe that, as Roosevelt wrote, the poor body, which but half an hour before had been so full of vigorous life, would never move again. When they had lost Simplicio more than 2 weeks earlier, the men had been deeply saddened. But Paixón's death was an even greater blow. They had never found Simplicio's body, and somehow that had made his death seem less real, less immediate. The sight of Paixón's broken body, however, would stay with them, a painful reminder of the violence and tragedy that they had witnessed that day. All that the men could do for Paixón now was give him as dignified a burial as they could manage. Rondon announced that he would name the falls and the mountains that surrounded them Paixón, as they had had the bad destiny of being the indirect cause and theater of the young man's murder. He decided to bury his camarada where he had died, with his head towards the mountain and his feet towards the river. The principal obstacle to Rondon's plan was that, having already abandoned most of their tools, the men did not have any shovels with which to dig a grave. While the officers stood watching, their hats removed, the camaradas used knives, axes, and their own hands to claw back the wet earth. When they finished, Roosevelt and Rondon, reverently and carefully, picked up Paixón's shoulders, while Lira, Kermit, Cherry, and Dr. Cajazeira supported his back and legs. Together they laid the blood-soaked body in its shallow grave, heaped a low mound over it, placed a rude cross at the head, and fired a volley in Paixón's honor. Then we left him forever, Roosevelt wrote, under the great trees beside the lonely river. Although finding Julio's gun had eased their minds, it did not ensure their safety. With nowhere to go and nothing to lose, Giulio would likely try to steal another gun or, at the very least, provisions from the expedition. If he was still feeling angry and vindictive, he could damage their dugout canoes or even try to kill them by pushing boulders over the cliff's edge while they were working on or near the river. Until they passed these rapids, moreover, the men would still be scattered across the gorge. In an effort to protect themselves and their cargo and canoes, they posted guards wherever they could. One man was stationed at each of the two camps, and another was assigned to follow the camaradas as they completed the baggage carry. Cherry, himself, guarded Lyra, Kermit, and their men as they lowered the rest of the canoes over the falls. Despite a determined struggle, the men were able to move only part of their baggage and two of their four canoes to the bottom of the falls before darkness fell. Since they could not risk losing any of their dugouts or even the smallest box of provisions, they would have to divide the party overnight, the first time they had had to do so since their expedition had begun. Some of the men slept at the head of the rapids that night, while the rest swung their hammocks between a clutch of trees that had somehow grown up among the boulders that littered a narrow strip of land at the bottom of the cliff. That night, as they helped Roosevelt struggle to reach the new camp, the men were struck anew by how sick he was. With the excitement and outrage of the murder circulating in his veins, the former president's urgent determination to take action had temporarily prevailed over the effects of his illness. As his chest heaved with each step up the steep side of the gorge to the new camp, however, it was painfully apparent to them all that he had lost the vitality that had awed them at the outset of their overland journey, not even 3 months earlier. At 5:30 p.m., Mr. Roosevelt arrived breathless with the great effort which he had made to climb up the slopes of the Rocky Mountain, Rondon noted. That violent exercise was too excessive for his state of health and made him suffer very much. Roosevelt's heart worried them now as much as his infected leg. For the past few days, the man who had torn through every backwoods he could find from Oyster Bay to Maine to Washington, D.C.'s Wild Rock Creek Park could hobble only a few steps before becoming utterly exhausted. A few days earlier, on a downhill walk with Roosevelt from one camp to the next, Cherry had been shocked by his friend's rapid and severe decline. As he and I went down the trail to our camp at the foot of the rapids, his heart was so affected that frequently he had to sit down and rest, Cherry wrote. He was evidently in great pain, because three or four times he threw himself on the ground and begged me to go on. Kermit was acutely aware of his father's serious condition, writing in his diary the day before the murder that he worried a lot about F.'s, father's, heart. His concern was rivaled by Cherry's. The respect that the American naturalist had long held for Roosevelt had deepened over the past few months into a brotherly affection, and he was as determined to bring him out of the Amazon alive as he was to get himself out. With each passing day, however, that goal seemed increasingly unreachable. There were a good many days, a good many mornings, when I looked at Colonel Roosevelt and said to myself, "He won't be with us tonight," Cherry wrote. "And I would say the same thing in the evening. He can't possibly live until morning." It was Roosevelt's earlier, although aborted, decision to take his own life, as much as his rapidly deteriorating health, that kept Cherry awake at night. Cherry had already lived through a friend's suicide, and he would never forget it, or his role in it. While on an earlier expedition, one of his campmates had approached him looking pale and drawn, but the naturalist recalled, "With the fire of decision burning in his eyes, 'Cherry, lend me your revolver,' the man had said. 'What are you going to do with it?' Cherry had asked. The answer had been quick and blunt. 'Shoot myself.' I thought, 'Is he desperate?' Cherry later wrote. 'Hysterical? Ill? Temporarily demented?' I talked with him for a few moments, not going into details, but probing the soundness of his state of mind. Then I took the gun from its holster and handed it over. He killed himself that day." Kermit and Cherry were not the only members of the expedition to worry about Roosevelt. Dr. Cajazeira, although he had his hands full administering prophylactics and treating all of the expedition's 19 men, including himself, for a wide variety of ailments, had begun to spend most of his days and nights hovering over his American commander. So closely did he watch Roosevelt that, in his official report, he dedicated an entire chapter to Colonel Roosevelt's health status. On the afternoon of April 4th, as the rest of the men tried to finish bringing down the last two canoes and the remainder of the provisions, Cajazeira and Roosevelt stayed behind at the camp. At about 2:30 p.m., while the two men were talking quietly, the doctor suddenly noticed that all of the color had drained from his patient's face and that he had begun to shiver uncontrollably. Cajazeira took Roosevelt's temperature and found that it was rising rapidly. Covering him as well as he could, he gave him another half gram of quinine to swallow. Since by that time, we were already deprived of almost everything, including medications, he wrote in frustration. Cajazeira wanted to move Roosevelt to a better camp than the makeshift one that they had set up amid the boulders the night before. He waited impatiently until the men finally finished the portage and, at 5 p.m., reloaded the canoes, with Roosevelt, Rondon, and Cajazeira riding in the largest, and were ready to set off downriver in search of a new campsite for the night. As an added precaution, in case Julio was still lurking about, the men decided to cross the river to the right bank. They had no sooner launched their four dugouts, however, than it began to rain. The downpour was the hardest they had had in several days, and it flooded forest and river, drenching most of us to the skin, Cherry wrote in his diary that night. Cajazeira wrapped Roosevelt in his waterproof poncho, but the men had no way to fit their rough canoes with awnings. By the time they crossed the river and found another campsite half an hour later, Roosevelt's temperature had skyrocketed to 103 degrees, and he was, in Cajazeira's words, restless and delirious. Roosevelt's condition continued to deteriorate at such a fast rate that Cajazeira began to inject quinine directly into his abdomen. Every 6 hours, the doctor would open his wooden medical box, which was covered with a spotted animal skin, and swung on a heavy hinge, pull out his silver syringe, and give his patient another half-gram injection. Despite all his efforts, however, Roosevelt's fever stubbornly refused to abate, his temperature falling by only a few fractions of a degree, Cajazeira noted with dismay. That night, while the camaradas lay wound up in their cocoon-like hammocks under dripping palm leaves and a black sky, the officers took turns watching over Roosevelt in their tiny, thin-walled tent. As his temperature once again began to rise sharply, Roosevelt fell into a trance-like state, and he began to recite over and over the opening lines to Samuel Taylor Coleridge's rhythmic poem, Kubla Khan. In Xanadu did Kubla Khan a stately pleasure-dome decree. In Xanadu did Kubla Khan a stately pleasure-dome decree. In Xanadu. As the night wore on, Roosevelt slipped in and out of consciousness. One moment he was looking directly at Kermit and asking him if he thought that Cherry had eaten enough to keep going, and the next he had forgotten his son's presence entirely and was feverishly murmuring to himself, I can't work now, so I don't need much food. But he and Cherry have worked all day with the canoes. They must have part of mine. While Kermit tried to calm and reassure his father, he felt a soft tap on his shoulder and turned to find Cajazeira, who had pulled himself out of a deep sleep to relieve the young man. At about 2 a.m., Rondon, in turn, relieved Cajazeira, taking his place next to Roosevelt's sagging cot. Although still determined to fight to the last for Kermit's sake, Roosevelt, in his few lucid moments that night, realized that he was so sick he might not be able to keep the promise he had made to himself and his son. He wanted one thing from Rondon now, reassurance that, if he fell into a coma, his co-commander would do the right thing and keep going. glassy-eyed and bathed in sweat, Roosevelt turned to Rondon and said, "The expedition must not stop. Go and leave me here." It wasn't until the sun had begun to wash over the treetops, turning them from black to gold to green, that Roosevelt's fever finally broke. The men's relief was heavy and universal, but not complete. Roosevelt had come so close to death that night that no one was willing to take any chances with his health. Rondon immediately ordered the camaradas to prepare to find yet another new campsite. They had run into more rapids at the end of the previous day and would probably spend most of this day trying to get around them. But Rondon pronounced last night's camp too wet and muddy for Roosevelt and insisted that they move. As it turned out, the best spot they found for a new campsite required a walk of half a mile. Although he was much improved from the night before, Roosevelt was still very weak, and his fever hovered around 101 degrees. Cajazeira planned to have some of the camaradas carry him to the next camp on his cot, but Roosevelt refused to be carted through the forest like a king or an invalid. As soon as Colonel Roosevelt learned of our decision, he opposed it strongly, finally stating that he did not want to become a heavy burden on the expedition, Cajazeira wrote. Helped along on quivering legs, Roosevelt slowly made his way to the next camp. Kermit, Cherry, Cajazeira, and Rondon at his side with his cot and collapsible chair. From time to time, when he became very tired, he would rest either on his bed or chair, Cajazeira would later recall. And so, he bravely made the journey. While Kermit obsessed over his father's health, his emotions rising and falling with each rally and relapse, the younger Roosevelt steadfastly ignored his own. He was suffering from a renewed attack of malaria, but he refused to admit how sick he was, continuing to work as though his hands weren't trembling, his body wasn't smoldering, and his head wasn't reeling. "I have fever," he admitted in his diary, "but not very bad." So determined was Kermit to soldier on that he did not allow himself a moment of rest. He spent the morning helping the camaradas get the dugouts through the rapids. Later, when Antonio Paresi rushed into camp shouting excitedly that there were monkeys nearby, Kermit and Cherry were the first to grab their rifles and race after him. They quickly spotted the animals, large woolly monkeys that were swinging through the treetops, "with surprising speed," Cherry wrote. Notwithstanding the monkeys' distance and agility, however, together Cherry and Kermit were able to bring down three of them. Kermit also caught a side-neck turtle, which has an unusually long neck that folds sideways under its shell rather than pulling straight back, and he brought it back to the camp for Franca to boil into soup. Despite his fever, Kermit even joined Rondon and Lira as they hiked downstream to try to find out what awaited the expedition. What they saw was worth the difficult trip. "I found," Kermit reported, "that after these rapids, we're out of the hills." The men had allowed themselves to believe that prediction in the past, only to be bitterly disappointed when new mountains and new rapids had risen up behind a sharp bend in the river. But whether Kermit was right or not, the hopeful news was welcome. "The fresh meat we all craved gave us renewed strength and energy," Cherry would later write. "And the fact that the mountains that had for so long hemmed us in seemed at last to be falling away from the river brought us new courage." The next day, April 6th, had a promising start as well. The men were finally beginning to feel as if they could predict, if not control, the dangers they might face downriver. To their delight, the hills began to drop away, just as Kermit had said they would, and the river slowly widened into a spacious bay. For the most part, our course was over the scarcely rippling surface of a broad, quiet stream, Cherry wrote in his diary. The expedition was finally leaving Pachon's sorrowful canyon. As the land leveled and the waters smoothed, the men were able to step back into their canoes and ride for the first time in a long time. The low, heavily forested terrain on either side of them melted into an impressionistic wash of green and brown as Rondon and Lyra rode the racing current. Unencumbered by cataracts or whirlpools, they were finally free to turn their full attention to their survey, cleaning their instruments, taking measurements, and making notes on the river's gently winding course. As they bent over their work, the two men were startled by a man's voice calling to them from the left bank. The cry, "Señor Coronel!" hung heavy with desperation in the thick, wet air. Rondon looked up to find a dark figure clinging to a broad tree branch that leaned far out over the river. After a moment of startled confusion, he finally recognized the powerful physique. It was Julio. Chapter 26. Judgment. Even Rondon was shocked by how pathetic Julio looked, crouching in the gnarled tree like a frightened animal, imploring for mercy and asking us to receive him on board. 3 nights alone in the jungle would have taken their toll on any of the men, but they had been especially excruciating for Julio. By now, the members of the expedition knew that, second only to wrath, fear was the muscular young Brazilian's most powerful emotion. He was, Roosevelt wrote, an arrant craven at heart, a strange mixture of ferocity and cowardice. If Julio had expected Rondon to brim with compassion and mercy at the sight of him, he did not know his commander. "It is not possible for me to stop the canoe now and to interrupt the survey," he called coldly to the desperate man. "Besides, it is best to wait for Mr. Roosevelt." Having said all that he had to say, Rondon returned his attention to his survey charts, and Julio watched in horror as the river swiftly carried his commander's canoe downstream. The reaction Julio received from the men in the 3 dugouts that followed gave him less hope than even his encounter with Rondon. They refused to look at the murderer, much less help him, passing by his tree in stony silence. Although they felt that Julio deserved a harsh punishment for the crime he had committed, they shuddered to imagine his fate. "Surely that murderer was in a living hell," Roosevelt wrote, as with fever and famine leering at him from the shadows, he made his way through the empty desolation of the wilderness. Seated in different dugouts and separated by several yards on a fast-moving river, Roosevelt and Rondon were unable to discuss Julio's reappearance until they reached the next camp. Some 7 miles after they passed Julio, the men came upon a large tributary that entered the River of Doubt from the right-hand side, and decided to camp in the protected corner of land formed by the two rivers. Roosevelt knew that his co-commander would want to survey the new river, and Rondon knew that Roosevelt would object to the delay that such a survey would necessitate. That night, after the camaradas had cleared a spot for the campsite and set up the officer's single tent, Rondon sat down with the ailing ex-president and told him that he wanted the expedition to pause in order to send some men back to look for Julio. Both Roosevelt's and Kermit's temperatures had risen again during the day, and they were feeling feverish and weak. But they remembered how Rondon had slowed the boat building a few weeks earlier so that Lyra could determine the latitude, and neither of them believed his story now. "Rondon," Kermit wrote in his diary that night, "vacillated about Julio with 100 lies. He wants to wait to take the latitude, but father won't let him." The next morning, with Lyra by his side, Rondon took up his case again, never mentioning the survey and focusing all of his arguments on the question of locating Julio. He argued that it was the duty of a Brazilian officer and of a man to do all that he could to find Julio and bring him back to civilization so that he could be tried for murder. Brazil did not have capital punishment, but even if it had, a government-orchestrated execution would be infinitely more merciful than the horrors Julio faced alone in the jungle. Even knowing all of this, the American officers did not want to take Julio back, and they were outraged by Rondon's suggestion that they lose an entire day of travel to search for him. What was our astonishment to hear Colonel Rondon announce that he intended remaining in the camp for the day, Cherry railed in his diary, and that he intended to send a couple of men back to look for the murderer, Julio. This resolution on Colonel Rondon's part is almost inexplicable in the face of facts regarding our own position. Our food supply is growing alarmingly less. Furthermore, our four canoes are already loaded to the limits. From our point of view, this delay and the trying to carry a prisoner places in jeopardy the lives of every member of the party. Laced with suspicions of ulterior motives, and fueled by the expedition's desperate circumstances, the argument that ensued between the Brazilian and the American officers over Julio was so heated that it fractured the bond, born of a shared sorrow and renewed sense of common purpose, that had formed among all of the men after Paixão's murder. When he and Roosevelt locked horns over the murderer's fate, Rondon would later write, "The clash was tremendous." Roosevelt regretted that they could not legally put Julio to death themselves. But as Rondon had made it clear that that was not an option in his country and under his watch, Roosevelt insisted that the only thing left to do was to abandon the camarada to his fate. "If we brought the murderer in, he would have to be guarded night and day on an expedition where there were always loaded firearms about, and where there would continually be opportunity and temptation for him to make an effort to seize food and a weapon and escape, perhaps murdering some other good man," he argued. "Whether the murderer lived or died in the wilderness was of no moment compared with the duty of doing everything to secure the safety of the rest of the party. The idea of wasting any more time, energy, or provisions searching for a murderer seemed almost criminal to Roosevelt. Finally, boiling with anger, frustration, and fever, he shouted at Rondon, "The expedition is endangered!" However, Roosevelt knew that this was not his decision to make. He, Colonel Rondon, was the superior officer of both the murderer and of all the other enlisted men and army officers on the expedition, and in return was responsible for his actions to his own governmental superiors and to the laws of Brazil, Roosevelt wrote. In view of this responsibility, he must act as his sense of duty bade him. As soon as his co-commander stepped aside, Rondon ordered two camaradas, Antonio Paresi and Luiz Correa, to hike back up the river and look for Julio. As the Americans had bitterly predicted, Rondon and Lira spent that day, April 7th, surveying the new tributary and determining the latitude of the Rio Roosevelt. "To take the greatest advantage possible of the stoppage which had been imposed upon us," Rondon would later write, "Lieutenant Lira and I occupied ourselves with the measurement of the rivers and the necessary astronomical observations for the calculation of the geographical coordinates of our position." When Roosevelt suggested that they also use the time to hike ahead to see what the expedition would face downriver, Rondon dismissed the idea as an unnecessary effort. Cherry, who had become deeply frustrated with his Brazilian commander, an emotion expressed almost nightly in his diary, was once again outraged. "Today Colonel Rondon did not even think it necessary to explore ahead the rapids whose roar we hear," he wrote in the simple paper and cardboard notebook that he used as a journal. "And only after Kermit and Colonel Roosevelt had protested was Antonio Correa sent ahead to make an examination." When the camarada returned later in the day, it was with a grim report. Although they had had smooth water and level land the previous day, traveling 22 miles, the greatest distance the expedition had yet to make in a single day on the River of Doubt, they would face another difficult series of rapids and falls soon after they launched their boats again the next morning. "It may well be that we are up against it again, and good and hard," Cherry wrote in his diary. However, as well as bringing bad news back with him, Antonio Correa also returned with dinner, a particularly large Amazonian catfish called a pirarara. The men were thrilled, because the beautiful pirarara, which flashed a bright orange tail and bore a massive bony head, was not only huge, measuring 3.5 feet long, but was, in Cherry's words, "a very good flavored fish." When they began to clean the catfish, however, the men were in for a surprise. Slicing open its belly, they found the head and arm of a monkey. "We Americans were astounded at the idea of a catfish making prey of a monkey," Roosevelt wrote, speculating that the monkey had probably been seized while drinking from the end of a branch, and once engulfed in that yawning cavern, there was no escape. Although the pirarara was a powerful fish, it is more likely that it had taken advantage of a rare opportunity and devoured an already dead monkey that had fallen into the river than that it had caught the animal alive. The idea of a fish catching its lunch on the banks of the river rather than inside it, however, was not beyond the realm of possibility in the Amazon, as the high-jumping arowana, or water monkey, proved. For the Brazilians, such fish were fairly common and of little interest compared with another even larger fish, the piraíba, which they told their American companions preys on men. The piraíba, which has been known to grow to 9 feet in length and weigh more than 300 pounds, is a bottom dweller, rising up from the murky depths to surprise its prey. Cajazeira himself had examined a piraíba that had been killed by 2 machete-wielding fishermen after, they claimed, the fish had lunged at them with open mouth and attempted to attack them. He told the men of the expedition that, because of its ability to wage a sneak attack, swimmers feared the catfish even more than caimans, which they could usually see and so had a better chance of avoiding. Rondon agreed with the doctor, adding that, in many of the villages he had visited along the banks of the lower Madeira River, the people had gone so far as to build stockades in the water just so they could have a place to bathe and swim without fear of an attack from piraíba. Night had fallen by the time Antonio Paresi and Luiz Correa returned from their search for Julio. As they stumbled into camp, it was immediately apparent to every man in the expedition that they were not only exhausted and hungry, but alone. Although they had spent all day looking for the fallen camarada, calling his name, firing their rifles, and building fires in the hope that the smoke would help him find his way to their little makeshift camp, they never even caught sight of him. The men concluded that Julio must have decided to try his luck with the Indians who had attacked Rondon and Lobo. It was questionable whether or not he would live to reach the Indian villages, Roosevelt wrote, which were probably his goal. Julio may have been better off trying to survive another night in the jungle alone than turning to the Cinta Larga for help. Like any inhabitant of the rainforest, the Cinta Larga did not coddle the weak or the vulnerable. Physical strength and self-sufficiency were prerequisites to surviving in their world. Julio's presence, moreover, would have posed an unacceptable risk to the Indians. The simple fact that he would have had to walk into one of their villages or hunting camps as an unannounced stranger would have placed him in grave danger. According to one account, many years later, one of the first outsiders known to seek help from the Cinta Larga was an English engineer who had become lost in the jungle and had stumbled upon a Cinta Larga village when he was on the verge of starvation. Having nothing else to offer as a gift, he gave the Indians his only possession, his knife. The Cinta Larga took the knife and, in return, gave the man food. After watching him eat his fill, one of the Indians walked up behind him and slit his throat, killing him with the very knife he had given them. Chapter 27 The Cauldron. Even as they speculated about Julio's fate, the 19 remaining members of the expedition knew that they were not much better off than he was. They had a handful of advantages, ranging from weapons to supplies to sheer numbers, over the man that they had just abandoned to the jungle. Each of those resources, however, had proved to be far less valuable than they might have imagined before reaching the rainforest. Their rifles, which they had assumed they could rely on to supplement their rations, had never fulfilled their promise. In a rare moment of foresight during the pre-journey planning in New York, Fiala had hired a company to pack the expedition's ammunition in zinc cases, 100 rounds to a case, to protect it from the corrosive effects of the jungle's heavy humidity. Even an endless supply of bullets, however, would have done them little good, since they could find no game to hunt. The best shot that any of them had taken on the banks of the River of Doubt had been Julio's deadly accurate bead on Paixón. So awkward and heavy were the expedition's dugout canoes that they were only slightly preferable to having no boats at all. Any hope that the men had found in the leveling landscape and smooth waters they had encountered upon leaving Paixón Canyon on April 6th was lost when they launched their boats again on the 8th. They encountered so many rapids that day that they made only 3 miles. The following day was even worse, allowing the expedition only 15 minutes of quiet water between sets of rapids. On the 10th, Roosevelt wrote wearily through the fog of his illness, we repeated the proceedings. A short, quick run, a few 100 meters portage, occupying, however, at least a couple of hours. Again a few minutes run. Again other rapids. The rapids of the River of Doubt had destroyed 6 of their canoes in less than a month's time. The problem, Roosevelt realized, was as much the boats that they were riding in as the river that they were descending. How I longed for a big Maine birch bark, such as that in which I once went down the Mattawamkeag at high water. It would have slipped down these rapids as a girl trips through a country dance, he wrote. But our loaded dugouts would have shoved their noses under every curl. As for their provisions, the men were now eating barely enough to stay alive, much less to fuel the hard work that they had to do in order to get through and around the rapids. My supper consisted of 1 soda cracker and a small portion of fish with a cup of coffee, Cherry wrote in his diary. Not a very hearty meal for a full-grown man. The officers did their best to supplement the camaradish diet with food from their own ration tins, but they had too little to spare, and the delicacies that Fiala had packed simply stirred the appetites of the rugged paddlers and porters. Cherry suspected that this near-starvation diet was at the root of many of their maladies. The lack of sufficient food is one potent reason why we are all physically below normal, he wrote. Cherry and Lyra had been battling dysentery for weeks, and 2 of the camaradas were so ill that the others feared for their lives. A long further delay, accompanied by wearing labor, would have almost certainly meant that the weakest among our party would have begun to die, Roosevelt wrote. Roosevelt himself was at the top of that list, but his son was not far behind. Although Kermit rarely mentioned his malaria in his journal, Cherry wrote that Kermit's fever was so bad that he was scarce able to stand. Deeply concerned, Dr. Cajazeira began to inject quinine directly into Kermit's arms, but his fever continued unabated. Kermit was so sick that he did not even notice when his dog, Trigueiro, leapt out of his dugout just as the paddlers pushed off from the bank. Trigueiro had been given to Kermit as a gift early in the expedition and had quickly become his closest companion. Kermit had even written about his dog in his letters to Belle, recounting their long, solitary walks across the Chapadon, and how Trigueiro would wish him good night at the end of the day by thrusting his muzzle into his master's hand as it hung over the side of his hammock. Despite Kermit's affection for Trigueiro, nothing could be done to retrieve him until the expedition found a place to camp for the night. The men had traveled roughly 200 miles by that point, but they still had at least 200 more to go until they reached the fork in the river where, they hoped, Lieutenant Pirineus would be waiting for them. Rondon's early decision to send Pirineus up the Aripuanan to meet their expedition with new provisions had proved prescient, and if all went according to plan, could save their lives. After all that had happened to them, however, they could not feel confident that if they did make it to the agreed-upon rendezvous point, Pirineus and his party would be there waiting for them. The Brazilian lieutenant faced a difficult voyage of his own, and there were no guarantees that he and his men had reached their destination. The possibility that they might not return home alive, once a remote and abstract idea, had become a corrosive, everyday burden for the members of the expedition. As the journey wore on, the Amazonian jungle, which had never seemed welcoming, had begun to feel not just dark and dangerous, but inescapably oppressive. It was a sensation that most outsiders who plunged into that dense, inscrutable wilderness experienced, and it left behind an indelible, almost violent impression. The Polish explorer and writer Arkady Fielder wrote that after he and his companions had spent months in the Amazon rainforest, something began to go wrong in us, coming daily into such close contact with the virgin forest we found, as so many other white men had found before us, that its grotesque forms and brilliant colors got on our nerves like a nightmare. It was stifling us. The whole exotic jungle became one gigantic cauldron of hatred and brutality. For outsiders who are forced to spend lengthy periods in the rainforest, one of its most oppressive and frequently mentioned features is its relentless monotony. Although their boats were passing through a world of infinite variety, to the members of the expedition everything had begun to look simply green. The creatures of the Amazon had become such masters of disguise that all that the men could see on either side of the river was verdant leaves and heavy vines. H.M. Tomlinson, an Englishman who had traveled along 2,000 miles of Amazonian rivers just a few years before Roosevelt's expedition, tried to explain this overwhelming sense of sameness by comparing the rainforest to the soaring sky and the endless sea. The forest of the Amazons is not merely trees and shrubs. It is not land. It is another element, he wrote. Its inhabitants are arborean. They have been fashioned for life in that medium, as fishes to the sea and birds to the air. Its green apparition is persistent, as the sky is and the ocean. In months of travel, it is the horizon which the traveler cannot reach. The camaradas were deeply affected by the forest's stifling monotony, the river's myriad dangers, and their own dark fears, and the American officers charted their emotional decline with growing alarm. Cherry discovered that a box of shells for his rifle had been stolen by some of the camaradas, who, he wrote in his diary, doubtless thought the cans contained meat. As the expedition already had little ammunition to spare, the theft was a serious one. My gun is thus rendered of little value for obtaining meat for our party, Cherry wrote. Even more damaging than the loss of the shells was the blow to the trust between the officers and the camaradas. No one could blame Julio this time. Rondon was willing to admit that physically his men were worn thin, but he continued to insist that mentally and emotionally they were as strong as ever. No sign of mental depression was manifested in them, and nothing could make us foresee the possibility of their losing determination to face and conquer new obstacles and resist the shock of the greatest misadventures and sufferings, he wrote forcefully. But Rondon was attributing to his men his own extraordinary fortitude, and expecting them to share his unshakable confidence that what they were doing was worth any sacrifice. The rainforest did not depress Rondon, because it was the only home he knew, more familiar to him even than his own wife and children. For the fever-racked Roosevelt, however, it was nothing of the kind. Rather, the expedition was becoming an ordeal of inhuman proportions, testing his strength and resolve as nothing he had encountered in a lifetime of self-imposed physical challenges. When he wasn't too sick to sit up, Roosevelt sought comfort and distraction in the world that he knew best, his library. For his trip to Africa, he had spent months choosing the books that he would take with him, ordering special volumes that had been beautifully bound in pigskin, with type reduced to the smallest legible size, so that the books would be as light as possible. Roosevelt, Kermit wrote, read so rapidly that he had to plan very carefully in order to have enough books to last him through a trip. He had not had that luxury when preparing for his South American journey, however. The plans for the Brazilian expedition came into being so unexpectedly that he could not choose his library with the usual care, Kermit noted. Among the books that had made it onto the dugout canoes for their river journey were Thomas More's Utopia, the plays of Sophocles, the last two volumes of Edward Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, and Marcus Aurelius and Epictetus. These and many others comforted me much, Roosevelt wrote, as I read them in headnet and gauntlets, sitting on a log. By this point in the expedition, Roosevelt had already read and discarded every book in his small traveling library, and was desperate for new reading material. He finally resorted to reading Kermit's Oxford Book of English Verse, even though he was unimpressed by it. The choice from Longfellow's poems appealed to him as particularly poor, Kermit recalled, and I think that it was for this reason that he disapproved of the whole collection. After tearing through the Book of English Verse as he lay burning with fever, Roosevelt turned, with great reluctance, to the Book of French Verse, which he considered to be better than nothing, but just barely. For French verse, Father had never cared. He said it didn't sing sufficiently. The Song of Roland was the one exception he granted, Kermit wrote. It was, therefore, a still greater proof of distress when he borrowed the Oxford Book of French Verse. Roosevelt read the book, but he complained so bitterly about it that his Francophile son finally threatened to take it away if he did not stop attacking his favorite works. Kermit, too, found in his few remaining books some measure of escape from the monotony of the rainforest, but not from its dangers. On April 11th, he finished reading A Retirada da Laguna by Brazilian novelist Visconde de Tonnay. The book revolved around Tonnay's impression of the War of the Triple Alliance, the 5-year conflict that had devastated Paraguay and orphaned Rondon. Every time Kermit picked up the book, rather than being spirited away to some other world, he was reminded in vivid, nightmarish detail of the ravages of starvation and the consequences of stumbling into the unknown. The book was, he wrote in his diary that night, a wonderful account, but not cheering to read with our own provisions so low and no knowledge of what's ahead of us. More effective than books for Kermit, although in even shorter supply, was a bottle of scotch that he and Cherry shared when, in Cherry's words, they felt the need of spiritual help. The two men had actually started out with 3 bottles, but since they had taken quite generous drinks, the first bottle had quickly disappeared. They were more conservative with the second bottle, but soon it too was gone. With only 1 bottle left and a seemingly endless river before them, Kermit and Cherry treated the whiskey they had left with great care. When we got the 3rd bottle out on the first night, Cherry would later recall, we held it up and took a pencil and marked off, this is the 10th, the 11th, the 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th. Marked off the amount we could take from that. You can imagine the marks were close together on the bottle. Like Kermit with his books, Cherry enjoyed his whiskey, but found little relaxation in it. With each passing day, the naturalist grew increasingly worried about the expedition, and he bristled at every decision that seemed to him to endanger it further. He continued to blame Rondon for most of the expedition's woes, venting his fury in the pages of his journal at night. But even Cherry's friends were not exempt from his criticism. On April 11th, the day after Trigueiro had leapt from Kermit's canoe and disappeared into the jungle, Cherry was appalled to learn that the expedition was stopping so that they could send 2 men back up the river to search for Kermit's dog. Personally, I feel this was a great mistake on Colonel Roosevelt's and Kermit's part, when we are so anxious to get ahead, Cherry wrote. His disapproval only deepened as the day wore on and the men did not return. Finally, at almost 5 p.m., the camaradas stepped into camp, with Trigueiro at their side. An entire day had been lost to searching for Kermit's pet. The camaradas must have wondered what kind of people go to such lengths to rescue a dog, but intentionally abandon a man to certain death in the wilderness. Cherry simply thought that it was a waste of precious time, and more important, that it sent the wrong message to Rondon about their willingness to linger in the rainforest. A precedence is established of which our companions will doubtless avail themselves when again they may wish to stop for a day or part of a day, he complained in his diary. By the end of the day, however, the delay had also yielded a piece of exceptionally good news. While waiting for the 2 searchers to return with Trigueiro, Luis Correa had taken 1 of the dugout canoes and gone fishing along the opposite side of the river from the expedition's campsite. As he worked his way along the shore, Cherry wrote excitedly, he found a place where a bajuca had been cut off with a knife or an axe. Not only did the use of a metal tool indicate that a rubber tapper rather than an Indian had cut the vine, but it was obvious to Correa that whoever had done the cutting had been sitting or standing in a canoe rather than on the river bank. Having gone this long without seeing anyone else on the river, the members of the expedition knew that the Indians who lived along its banks were not, as Cherry put it, canoe Indians, making it all but certain that rubber tappers had reached this far up the river in boats. This was the first mark of the outside world that the men had seen since they had launched their dugouts on the River of Doubt 1.5 months earlier. It was a sign of hope, a sign that salvation lay within reach. Part 6. Deliverance. Chapter 28. The Rubber Men. If the discovery of a knife-cut vine offered the men the first tangible sign that they might yet emerge from the rainforest alive, it did not provide any immediate relief. On the contrary, it raised the possibility of a new danger associated with the region that they were approaching. A no-man's land between unmapped jungle and the Amazon's rough pioneer civilization. The penetration of outside pioneers into the Amazon had been far from organized or peaceful, centering on rough, impoverished rubber tappers, or seringueros. The tappers who had reached this far up the River of Doubt were likely alone, afraid, and in dangerous straits themselves. In approaching their huts from upriver, moreover, the members of the expedition were crossing the frontier from the wrong direction. The only humans the settlers expected to see coming from the river's headwaters were hostile Indians, and they would do whatever they felt was necessary to defend themselves. Seringueros were, by default, the true settlers of Brazil's interior. When Henry Ford had introduced the Model T in 1908, the Amazon had been the world's sole source of rubber. The wild popularity of these automobiles and the seemingly insatiable demand for rubber that accompanied them had ignited a frenzy in South America that rivaled the California gold rush. In The Sea and the Jungle, H.M. Tomlinson complained that the only thing Brazilians saw in their rich rainforests in 1910 was rubber. It is blasphemous that in such a potentially opulent land, the juice of one of its wild trees should be dwelt upon as though it were the sole act of providence, he wrote. The passengers on the riverboats are rubber men, and the cargoes are rubber. All the talk is of rubber. 2 years before Roosevelt had set sail for South America, his friend, the great American naturalist John Muir, had been similarly astonished by the rubber lust that he had witnessed as he traveled through the Amazon. Into this rubbery wilderness, thousands of men, young and old, rush for fortunes, he marveled. Half crazy, half merry, daring fevers, debilitating heat, and dangers of every sort. By the time Roosevelt reached the Amazon, the dangers were still there, but the promise of riches had all but disappeared. The bottom had dropped out of the South American rubber boom in 1912, when the Amazon lost its lock on the market. 36 years earlier, an Englishman named Henry Wickham had smuggled Hevea brasiliensis seeds, the most popular species of Amazonian rubber tree, out of Brazil. Those seeds had then been cultivated at Kew Gardens, and the British had eventually planted their predecessors in tropical Malaysia. There, far from their natural enemies, the trees could be planted in neat rows with no fear that a blight would destroy the entire crop, as it likely would have done in South America. Labor in Malaysia was also not only cheap but readily available, and much more easily controlled. So successful had been the transfer of rubber trees to the Far East that by 1913, Malaya and Ceylon were producing as much rubber as the Amazon. Because of the cost in time-consuming experimentation and the difficulty of finding reliable labor, very little effort had been made even to try to cultivate rubber trees in South America. Brazilian tappers, therefore, had to live where the trees did. In order to find untapped trees and claim a small slice of land as their own, they had to keep moving deeper into unexplored territory. By the time Roosevelt's expedition descended the River of Doubt, the Seringueros had become the point of intersection between the Amazonian wilderness and the outside world. Settling the Amazon, however, was even more perilous than settling the American West. Not only was it a difficult, lonely life, but it was an almost impossible job. A man could do little more than clear a pocket of land just large enough to hold his own small hut and a subsistence garden. The death rate was dismally high. Many of the dangers that the members of the expedition had faced since setting off on their river journey were a part of the Seringueros' daily existence. Not surprisingly, the life of the Seringueros appealed to only the most desperate of men. Such a man, Roosevelt wrote, the real pioneer must have no strong desire for social life and no need, probably no knowledge, of any luxury or of any social comfort.